Dr. Bicky is our speaker today. He is a career educator and author, and he is currently serving as a principal in the middle school in Howard County, Maryland. He has a model for school improvement that is that has been used around the country, and I don't want to take too much of his time, so feel free to, if you have any questions, you can email those to us at questions@ahaprocess.com. Is that correct, Justin?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So if you have any questions throughout the seminar, we have muted your lines just to kind of cut back on the background noise. But if you have any questions, feel free to send those to us at questions@ahaprocess.com, and we will make sure that we get those through as many as possible in the hour. So without further ado, Dr. Dickey, go ahead and take it away.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you an instructional model that we've used here at our school and other schools across the country to promote student achievement. I want to describe the integrated approach before we get started, and then I'll talk about the components of the approach, and then we'll focus on one of the eight components of the approach, which is performance-based objectives. So the integrated approach is what I call a diagnostic and prescriptive framework for teaching and learning and leading school communities to higher levels of student achievement with the focus really on all students, regardless of race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, English proficiency, or special needs. And my current school, in 2006-2007, was the lowest performing school in the school system and one of the lowest performing schools in the state of Maryland. And we implemented the integrated approach in our school and met with high levels of success. Coming into the building, 9% of our special education population were doing math at the state standard. That is, 9% of the students receiving special education services were passing the annual state assessment, and 25% of the special education population was passing the reading assessment. Fast forward two years later, and take a look at that very same special education population, went from 9% proficient to 60% proficient, with double-digit gains two consecutive school years. The second school year of implementation, a 25% gain in the area of math, and a 46% gain in the area of special education reading. And the same applies to our ELL population, most of which are Spanish speakers, 22% at the beginning of our tenure here with the integrated approach of our ELL population were doing math at the state standard. 1 year later, 52.3% gain to 77.8% percent of our ELL population on grade level or above. The same applies to reading, starting out with 26.3% proficient to a 1 year gain of 47.6% to a total of 73.9% proficient just after 1 year of implementation of the approach. And you know, when I took a look at in 2006-2007 at the performance of non-minority students, so our Caucasian population performing at 72% proficient in mathematics after 1 year of implementation, 91% proficient. And so the approach, is effective regardless of race or ethnicity or service group. So we have the 5 race-based service groups and the 3 service groups, and the service groups include students who qualify for free and reduced meals, students who receive special education services, and students who speak English as a second language and therefore receive services. Regardless of the student group, we've seen significant gains, and we've replicated the model, as you have said when you introduced me, in other schools around the country. But one thing that I want to know before I get into the details of the approach is, even the students who didn't make the mark for proficient or the mark for meeting the standard or receiving the standard, 2/3 of the students who failed to meet the standard. 3/4 of the students who failed to meet the standard did not meet the standard by one question. So, for example, out of the, I used to have about 100 kids in every grade level who were reading or doing math below grade level. Now that number is 10. This school year, that number is 10 in each grade level. And so out of 9 students who failed, 15 students in grade 7 who failed to meet the reading standard in the school year 2008-2009, 9 of those students missed by one question. And so not only does it accelerate students, it also closes the gap for students who traditionally underperform. And so if you look at my Asian student population, prior to the integrated approach, 80% of those students were reading and doing math on grade level, and now that number is about 99%. And so it works for all student groups. The 8 components for the integrated approach are as follows. 1, it addresses lowered expectations of all persons who have access to students, it addresses lowered expectations for all persons who have access to parents, and it addresses lowered expectations among faculty and staff. You know, what person in your school, in your learning community, will stand up at a faculty meeting and admit that they have low expectations for students based upon the student group into which they fall? No one will do that. But I refer to in my book, The Integrated Approach to Student Achievement, I refer to lowered expectations as carbon monoxide because it's silent and it's odorless, but it is deadly when unaddressed. And so the integrated approach gives school communities a concrete way to address and to eradicate lowered expectations. Secondly, the approach addresses establishing a culture of instruction. And what does that mean? You know, when I go into schools and do professional development sessions, I ask people to jot down for me on an index card, describe to me their culture of instruction. And so, everyone in the room goes blank. Their faces go blank. And so, I start with an analogy. And so, I ask, are there people of Irish descent in the room, or Polish descent in the room? And then people will say yes. And I say, well, what religion do people of Irish descent commonly practice? And they'll give me that common religion. And I'll ask, are there people of Asian descent? And I'll ask them to give me something about the Asian population that an Asian person would know right away. And then I use an example of people of African American descent, which I am, and I ask them, what do people of African American descent call people who are close to the family but aren't actually related to the family? And all the African American people in the room can say, we call them cousins. And so if you belong to a cultural group, all of us belong to some type of group or cultural group or religious group, you know the tenets of that group, and you know the ins and the outs, you know the taboos, you know what's expected of you if you belong to that group. So then why is it when we talk to groups of teachers and people in learning communities who are supposed to be speaking the same instructional language, they don't? And so this approach gives concrete steps for addressing the necessity of establishing a culture of instruction which concentrates on using common instructional language and common understanding of that which is assessed. Third, this approach teaches learning communities how to examine data in order to set the imperative for change, because many schools are not underperforming as an entire school community. There may be pockets of underperformance in schools. And so is there an imperative for all students in a particular school? No, there may be just an imperative for groups of students in a school. But if the practices and best practices that are currently under use in your school were good enough, then they would have worked. All students would be performing at high levels. So taking a look at how student groups have been performing, looking at trend data, may set the imperative for change. And this approach does represent significant changes in ways of thinking and ways of doing. Fourth, the approach focuses on analyzing the demands of the curriculum, and it exposes teachers and leaders to that which students are expected to know and be able to demonstrate as measured by performance on the state assessment. Now, we know that national standards are coming, but state standards will mirror national standards for reading and mathematics. There'll just be fewer of them. And the issue that teachers have across the country these days are that there are too many skills to be taught and not enough time to teach it. And so the national standards will do a better job of identifying a limited number of math skills to be taught by grade level and a limited number of reading-related or English-related skills to be taught to students by grade level. So this approach is consistent with what's coming in the near future. Fifth, the approach addresses developing an action plan for teaching skills in the tested areas and also developing teacher competence and confidence. For example, if I were to ask a room full of teachers, principals, I've done it with teachers, principals, assistant supers, and superintendents, we know that students are asked vocabulary and context questions on criterion reference tests that your students take in your individual state. But if I were to ask a room full of educators, when you see the root word GREG, and I get blank stares, or if I ask what is the root word, what is the Latin root word PHY or pathy, what does that mean? I get blank stares, but students beginning in grade 3 are being asked to recognize unfamiliar words. But if students are not taught, if teachers are not aware, and students are not taught with the awareness of the teacher how to look at unfamiliar words and break them apart by their root and their base and their suffix to understand the word, then how are they going to perform on standardized assessments? And so root word GREG means group. And so a student who is academically in the area of reading has an average vocabulary of 2,500 words. But in order to read on grade level, a student needs to have a vocabulary of 25,000 words. But if I understand that GREG root word Latin means group, then I can begin and that understanding Regis, fully standing out from the group, gregarious, loving groups or, being excited by groups, congregate, group together, the act of grouping together, ATE, the suffix act of, and the list goes on. So what this approach does is it unravels the skills that teachers must have in order for those skills to be transferred to students. And it does not allow assumptions to be made about teacher knowledge of the skills that students will have to be on skills on which students will be assessed. And it does it in a way that does not bring any type of negative attention to a teacher that may not have the skill, because you may have a principal that may not be aware of the skills by which their schools are being measured, intimately at least. And seventh, which is the focus point of our conversation today, are composing higher order objectives that ensure that all students are exposed to instruction not only along with the state standards, but also extends beyond the rudimentary, so that requires that students, all students, regardless of their status in a student group, are exposed to rigorous instruction. And then finally, the eighth step, explicit instruction, which is really built upon the gradual release model. And so it provides a student-centered outline, this approach does, for planning, a teacher-centered outline, for planning and facilitating instruction that meets the diverse needs of learners under the gradual release model, which you may know as the I do, we do, you do, or cooperative learning after corporate instruction, followed by guided practice, and then individual practice. So it's called different things all over the country, but the teacher models what they want students to be able to do, gives the students an opportunity to demonstrate acquisition of that skill, followed by group work where students can make sure that they coach one another so that they understand the skill before they're required to perform or demonstrate mastery of that skill in the independent setting. So with the overview, John, let's talk about you have handouts available that were sent to you. Let's take a look at the objectives. Most instructional objectives can be grouped into three categories. And so if you take a look at the outline, we have identified three types of objectives that we see in classrooms every day that I see all over the country. Number one would be flawed. So a flawed objective contains some type of deficiency. Something's missing from the objective, or some component of the objective is in the wrong order, or something's misplaced. A content-driven objective is what people in their 30s, like me, remember from going to primary school and secondary school. They were objectives that were straight out of the curriculum guide. And third is the kind of objective that the model recognizes as the goal, as a gold standard, and that is a performance-based objective that's linked to the content or the essential curriculum, the curriculum that your school system requires that teachers teach in English and reading and social studies and so forth. And it's also linked to a state standard or an assessment limit. So an assessment limit is your State Department, and the national standards will do this later, your State Department of Education has identified the most that will be assessed by grade level and the least that should be taught in the classroom by the classroom teacher. So that's the definition of the assessment limit. So performance-based objective is linked to your content area curriculum, is linked to a state standard that will be assessed, or to a higher-order thinking skill that goes beyond that which will be assessed. So performance-based objectives should be rigorous, and we'll see that in just a minute. A performance-based objective is defined, and it has two parts. So it's defined as having a know and a do. So the know represents the prerequisite content-related knowledge or skill that students must have in order to be able to demonstrate mastery of the second part of the objective, which is the in order to. And we'll see some examples, and so this will come alive in just a moment. And then the do, which makes the objective performance-based, it represents that which students are expected to be able to do by the close of the lesson or by the close of a series of a lesson, and it must always be measurable or quantifiable, and it's always linked to an assessment limit or to some type of higher-order thinking skill. So let's take a look at the first objective under reading and try to categorize this. I'll think aloud the process of categorizing this as a flawed objective, content-driven objective, or performance-based objective. So it says to distinguish between fact and opinion in order to identify a passage as fact or opinion. Okay? So students will be able to distinguish fact from opinion could be part of your essential curriculum. So students are taught in reading, beginning in grade 3, how to distinguish fact from opinion, and they're taught that for good reason, because later on, fact and opinion will be used to perform another task. Excuse me for one moment. I'm still running the school. So students will be able to distinguish fact from opinion in order to identify a passage's fact or opinion. So you see the connection between the essential curriculum. But in order to identify a passage's fact or opinion, that doesn't happen. There are text structures or organizational patterns that authors use to write text for the purpose of the person who is reading the text. I'm getting a lot of wind in the background. Okay. Authors use organizational patterns in order to organize text in a way so that the reader of the text can get information effectively from the text. And those text structures do not include fact or opinion. You may see on a CRT or criterion reference test or your state exam, you may see a cause and effect passage. You may see a spatial descriptive passage. You may see a main idea passage. You may see a sequential chronological order passage, but you'll never see a fact or opinion passage. So this objective is flawed. But can you rewrite this objective to make it a performance-based objective? Absolutely. Students will be able to distinguish between fact and opinion in order to do what? What state standard is the prerequisite? What is fact and opinion the prerequisite of? It is a prerequisite of being able to make inferences. So this objective could be rewritten as students will be able to distinguish between fact and opinion in order to make inferences. Why? Because the prerequisite for making an inference is a fact. So if students cannot distinguish fact from opinion, they can't make an inference. So number two, students would be able to use a jigsaw to state the main idea in a portion of a text. So you can already see that there's an activity in this objective. So using a jigsaw, students will be able to use a jigsaw is not linked to the essential curriculum. It's an activity that you may use to, you may use it as a vehicle to teach a skill if it is severely flawed. Let's take a look at an objective that I commonly see. So let's skip to number four. Students will be able to analyze the extent to which an author fulfills the reading purpose. Now, being able to analyze the extent to which an author fulfills the reading purpose is important, but the issue with this objective is, beyond the fact that it doesn't have a performance-based piece or a prerequisite piece, it is limited to page 62. So when I walk into classrooms that have objectives like this one, then you, and you ask kids, what are they doing? They'll tell you they're working on page 62. And they don't connect with the fact that they are analyzing the extent to which the author fulfills the reading purpose. And authors don't really fulfill reading purpose. They fulfill writing purposes. So this objective is flawed for two reasons. So let's look at an objective that is written appropriately, that is considered to be a performance-based objective in reading, and then we'll go to another content area. That would be number seven. Able to analyze informational text in order to determine the sequential order of events. Is it prerequisite? No. Students will be able to analyze informational text. Because the answer is yes. 80% of the criterion reference tests that you take, regardless of the state of origin, is built with informational text, and 20% of the reading assessments are built with literary text. And so a student who has the ability to analyze informational text will develop an ability to determine sequential order of events. Let me look at a more concrete, a better example of reading. Students will be able to identify different types of text. This is number 12. Students will be able to identify different types of text in order to predict author's purpose. So this objective, the no part of this objective is students will be able to identify different types of text. Well, what are the different types of text? We've already gone through those. Cause and effect, main idea, sequential, chronological order, and the prerequisite knowledge that students need to have in order to predict or to determine author's purpose, that would be better written as determine author's purpose, is to be able to identify a plethora of organizational patterns so that when they see organizational patterns, they associate those organizational patterns with keywords, and then they also begin to associate those organizational patterns with author's purpose or the intended outcome that the author has for the reader reading the text. So if we take a look at social studies objectives, we'll try to categorize some of these objectives as well. Let's look at number eight. When I was a high school student in a social studies class, my social studies teacher taught me how to memorize facts related to the U.S. Constitution. So I could, at the end of that unit or at the end of that quarter or at the end of that school year, I could regurgitate a lot of facts on the U.S. Constitution. But that really would not help me with a performance-based assessment, because all state tests are performance-based assessments. They ask students to do something with their knowledge. And so this objective would have prepared me for a performance-based assessment, even though those assessments were not popular in the early 90s when I was a high school student. So number eight says students will be able to analyze the Magna Carta and the U.S. Constitution in order to compare and contrast documents central to the formulation of federal law. What makes this objective a performance-based objective? Doesn't just teach me about the U.S. Constitution, but it teaches me to compare and contrast one document to another, and also to do something that's higher order thinking, which is compare and contrast them to documents central to the formulation of federal law in other nations. So me being exposed to instruction at this level, according to in alignment with this model, is important for all kids, because you may have a teacher say, well, I would not teach this objective to my special education population or to my low-performing classes. And what that does is perpetuate their performance, their low performance, and their inability to think at higher levels. And so this approach exposes all students to this type of instruction on a consistent basis. If we take a look at objective number one for social studies, that students will be able to identify the impact of Christianity on Rome in order to analyze the effects of religion on a larger society. This is a seventh grade objective. And so what's the prerequisite skill, or what's the know, what must students know in order to analyze the effect of religion on a larger society? Well, because the essential curriculum for seventh grade in my school system is Christianity in Rome, we connect Christianity in Rome with what's not in the curriculum guide, a high-order thinking skill, which is being able to analyze the effects of religion on a larger society. Now, when will students ever have to analyze the effects of religion on a larger society in the essential curriculum? They won't. And perhaps they won't develop the ability to think critically in social studies. So what the approach does is it forces critical thinking across subject areas. Let's take a look at science. Objective number three in science. The students will be able to identify the parts of a cell. Okay, is that essential? Yep, students must be taught to identify the parts of a cell. And in my school system, I believe that is seventh grade science. Okay, but that's not enough. So when I was taught seventh grade science, my teachers taught me how to identify the parts of a cell. But what they didn't do was teach me how to do something with what I know, which is to use my ability to identify parts of a cell to classify cells as plants or animals, which represents a higher order thinking skill. And so students have to classify on performance-based assessments. Students have to compare and contrast on performance-based assessments. Students have to analyze on performance-based assessment. But if our daily objective does not require them to do so, then we're not sure if we're preparing kids for performance-based assessment under the integrated approach model. So let's take a look at English. Objective number three, it says, students will be able to read Roll of Thunder in order to complete a graphic organizer on plot development. And so we already know that the criteria for a performance-based objective must have something, a link to the essential curriculum and a link to an assessment limit or a higher order thinking skill. So let's look at this one. Read Roll of Thunder, okay? Students will read Roll of Thunder. Of course, they're going to read. They're in school. So the word read would not appear in an objective because it doesn't represent an appropriate link to the essential curriculum. Now, you may think that Roll of Thunder may, because that's a novel, that may represent an appropriate link to the essential curriculum, but it does not meet the requirement. So we know students are going to read because they're in school. We know they're going to read novels because they're in school. So you do not need to put in a title of a text in an objective because it doesn't reinforce to kids when they look at the objective or when they make references to the objective during the instruction that they're learning a skill. So they'll think that what they're doing in class is only limited to Roll of Thunder, and they won't transfer the skill that they're learning in English to a situation or an instructional moment in another content area. So that whole idea, the research-driven idea of transferability of skill, and I'll explain that later in just a second once I get through this objective. So we know reading and Roll of Thunder is inappropriate for the objective. So see, graphic organizer on plot development. So they're going to read Roll of Thunder in order to complete a graphic organizer. Well, of course you would use a graphic organizer to help kids to organize their thoughts and to build their understanding and to build their competence with a particular skill. But a graphic organizer is an activity. It's a vehicle that is used, so it doesn't belong in a performance-based objective. The only thing that's really left here is plot development. So really what the teacher was trying to say is that students are going to understand plot development. So they're going to understand exposition, rising action, climax, resolution. And so this objective needs to be rewritten. It's totally flawed. And so what is the prerequisite of students being able to understand plot development? That's the answer to this objective question. So I need an objective that requires students to be exposed to a prerequisite skill for being able to develop or to plot the beginning to the end of a story, whether it be a story, a fiction text, or nonfiction course of events. Let's take a look at another English objective that is written in the performance base, that meets the performance base criteria. Number 8 under English. It says students will be able to identify the components of a tale. Okay? So would students be taught the components of a fairy tale in English? Absolutely. So that's the no. That's what students must know. And so the teacher would spend some time teaching that, teaching the components of a fairy tale. But so what? What are they going to do with that knowledge? Because kids will ask all the time, well, why am I doing this? Why am I learning this? And so the in order to part of the objective answers that question. So you are learning to identify the components of a fairy tale so you can compare and contrast U.S. versions of a fairy tale with European versions of a fairy tale. And that teaches kids to be critical thinkers. We know that compare and contrast, students will be asked to compare and contrast on a performance-based assessment or a state exam. And the second part of this objective really does come from the teacher's knowledge of how students will be assessed at the end of the school year or in April or March on performance-based assessment. Now, mathematics. Let's look at number 2. Students will be able to determine the value of a radius. So are students taught the value of radius? Absolutely. That's necessary in sixth grade math in most states. So why do I need to be able to determine the value of a radius? So that I can perform. And what will I be doing? What's the do on this objective? And that is, I must be able to find the area of the circumference of a circle. What you find on chalkboards in classrooms across the country is, you'll find this objective written as students will be able to find the area of a circle, the area or the circumference of a circle. But the prerequisite skill will be missing. And so students need to see that what they're learning one day is connected to what they learned the day before. And if we take a look at another math, a final math objective, number 6, students will be able to find the area of individual geometric features. In most states, that's an 8th grade assessment limit, or that's 8th grade essential curriculum. So what examples of individual geometric figures, so circles, squares, rectangles, parallelograms, and so why is it important for me to be able to find the area of a geometric figure? Because on performance-based assessments, state exams, criteria and reference tests, students are given a rectangle, or visualize a rectangle, and at the top of the rectangle, there's a semicircle attached to the right and to the left of the rectangle, and a semicircle attached to the bottom of the rectangle. So they're not asked to simply find the area of a rectangle, they're asked to find the area of a composite shape. So they have to be able to know the area of these half circles plus the area of the rectangle in order to find the proper answer choice on the performance-based assessment. And so you heard me talk a lot about objectives, performance-based objectives, what components they should have in order for students to perform at high levels on the standardized assessment. But what I found is that if your teachers plan objectives that represent a link to the essential curriculum and an assessment limit or a higher order thinking skill, then no matter what test students are given, whether it be the state exam or the quarterly assessment in math or the benchmark assessment in reading, students perform at much, much higher levels because they are critical thinkers and the instruction does not stop at remembering and understanding. But these objectives represent application, analyzing, evaluating, synthesizing, and at the top of Bloom's taxonomy for cognitive demand, creating. But I guess what we can do is we can open up to any questions you might have.
At this point, we still haven't had anyone email any questions. If you have questions. If you'll send those to questions@ahaprofits.com, then I'll be glad to.
Okay, including questions about some of the objectives that I did not touch. I wouldn't mind, hitting some more of the objectives or going back to explain more about what makes the objective performance base. I can do that as well. And so until I get questions, we can do that. Let's take a look at on the reading objectives on the first page of what you have. Number 9, it says students will be able to identify the purposes of reading in order to make judgments about the effectiveness of words and phrases used to persuade the reader. And so the essential curriculum piece of this objective is students being able to identify the purposes of reading. So why do you read something? To be entertained, to get information, to be persuaded. And so that this is what the teacher would be teaching, and this objective would stay up on the board for a few days. And so some people believe that you need a new objective every day. But that represents getting through the curriculum for the sake of getting through the curriculum, but not getting through the curriculum and having the students where you want them to be with their understanding. And so the second part of this objective requires students to think at a higher level, and that is to make judgments. And so you'll see this as an eighth grade objective or a high school objective. So once students have identified the purpose for reading, then they use that knowledge in order to make judgments about the effectiveness of words used by the author to persuade the reader. And so most students who are performing, who traditionally underperform, are not exposed to rigorous instruction. And so they never come out of the performance rut that they're in because, you know, teachers no fault of their own and principals no fault of their own. They have not been exposing their student body to instruction that's rigorous indeed. People may say that they are in word, but what about indeed? And these objectives guarantee that students, regardless of their student group status, are exposed to rigorous instruction on a daily basis. So let's look at an English objective, number 6, and that would be on the second page of the document that you have. It says students will be able to analyze the literary elements. So are literary elements taught in elementary through high school? Absolutely. So personification, metaphor, simile, kennings if it's high school. And so what? So students, the prerequisite knowledge, the no, is students will be able to analyze literary elements. So analyze, in this case, the State Department says in most states, analyze means to take apart and put back together. So you want students to take apart a metaphor and put it back together. Take apart personification and put it back together for the purpose of being able to do what? Interpret figurative language. So when they get, they're exposed to a play that's written during Shakespearean times, that they would recognize that this author, Shakespeare, uses quite a few literary elements to say something to them that's pretty simple. So you have an eighth grader who, you know, uses their eighth graders or high school students, they have their own language, they have a language of their own, if you ask me. But they begin to understand that this was Shakespeare's language of his own that he used, because they're able to analyze, take apart, put back together literary elements in the text in order to understand some text that may seem dense to them. But once they understand the literary elements, the text is not dense. And that not only can they read it, but they can comprehend what they've read if the instructions they get is at this level. We can take a look at number 7 under English. It says students will be able to identify events of the plot. So is that essential curriculum? Do students need to know how to identify events in the plot? Absolutely. So that represents a no. And to do, what am I going to do with my ability to identify events of plot? I'm going to use it to analyze connections between character, setting, and plot. And, you know, once you start writing these types of objectives, what it does for classroom teachers and for instructional leaders is that it takes, they actually participate in the learning process. And so why can't their students identify plot events and in order to analyze connections between character settings and plot? It is because the people who are providing them with instruction kind of stay away from this objective because they may not be comfortable with planning instruction. If there's no professional development in the building on this objective and how to mix essential curriculum objectives with performance-based assessment limits, and people stay away from it and kids don't learn it. And when they get to the performance-based assessment, the kids can't demonstrate their knowledge of it and they can't demonstrate adequate yearly progress. So what we've done with the integrated approach is we participate in monthly professional development sessions by content area, and we talk about, well, what does the State Department mean by this objective number 7, this assessment limit, analyzing connections between character, setting, and plot? What does that mean? And so we talk about what that means, and then once we figure that out, and in the beginning, it's everyone figuring it out together. Once we figure it out as a content area, then we know how to teach it, and we can think about the misconceptions that we had in our own understanding of it, so that when we stand in front of the kids and teach it, or when we come in the classroom as observers, we have look fors, and we know how to deal with misconceptions that students may have while they're learning the content. Do we have any questions yet?
Still haven't seen any come through.
Okay, I'm going to try to say something interesting so we can get a question or two. Let's look at number 5 on the mathematics. It says students will be able to identify multiples of numbers. So multiples of numbers is a third grade essential curriculum skill. And so if you're an elementary school teacher, you're teaching kids how to identify multiples of numbers. So what? So the know here is so that they can, it's a prerequisite of the do, so that they can order, so that they can subtract fractions with unlike denominators. Let's just say denominators, excuse me. So what we find is that if kids don't understand the multiples of numbers in grade 3, 4, and 5, when they get to 8th grade, they have issues with adding and subtracting fractions. And so one of the biggest impediments to student performance at the middle school level on standardized assessments is students' understanding of fractions and decimals and factors of whole numbers. And so if you have an elementary school where you have students who are underperforming in grade 5, you have to go back and look at the objectives the objectives and the instructions they were given in grades 3 and 4, and that will give you some idea on where you went wrong as a learning community, and I hate to say where you went wrong, but where students may not have been exposed to the essential curriculum wrapped up in an assessment limit early on. And so what we've done is we have taken the guesswork out of, will our students pass a basic competency skill in math and reading? Because we all know that state assessments are not even written on grade level. So if you take a look at an average 8th grade state exam, it's written on the 4th or 5th grade level. And so we know in advance how our kids are going to perform because we have been exposing them to short-cycle assessments, and these short-cycle assessments are always attached to the in-order-to part of the objective. So, for example, if you look at objective number 3 under reading on page 1, it says students will be able to analyze word choice in order to identify and explain the author's argument. The know here is students being able to analyze word choice. And the do here is students being able to use their knowledge of word choice to identify and explain the author's argument or their point of view or their bias toward a particular subject. So what we do is we take the in order to part of every one of our objectives and we create a short cycle assessment. And so students come into school on Monday and they get a short 5-question assessment on author's argument. So every performance-based objective that you look at in our building, there is the in order to part of it is a short cycle assessment, 5 questions, and we test students' ability on what we know they're going to be tested on at the end of the school year. And then we spend a few minutes each day across content areas. We try to integrate it. That's why it's called integrated. So we try to integrate student knowledge of author's argument in English, in reading, and social studies. And then we give them short cycle assessment again at the end of the week. And we see significant gains in their ability to use word choice to identify or to explain the author's argument.
Okay, we have had a couple of questions come in now. The first one is from Dr. Anita Moore. She asked, how do you measure that the students have achieved the objective, and then do you include a specific number of elements that are required?
Okay. One of the components of the integrated approach is after we determine which skills, so there are about 30 skills in every grade level in every state in mathematics and reading that students must be able to, that students must master in order to demonstrate adequate yearly progress on most performance-based assessments. So after we identify those skills, and those skills are skills like, and I'm going to set up the answer, I'm going to set up my answer to the question before I answer the question. In reading, those skills are generalizations, making inferences, drawing conclusions, main idea, word parts, so prefixes, root words, and suffixes. And so once we've identified those skills, and once we've gotten intimate knowledge of the demand of those skills by grade level, then we create the short cycle assessment, and then we collect data from the short cycle assessment. So let me back up. A sixth grader across the country only has to, with particular assessment limits, kind of touch the bottom, demonstrate, you know, limited knowledge of the assessment limit. So a sixth grader has to identify a text feature. So they have to be able to recognize bold words, italicized words, underlined words, colored words in text. Okay. But an eighth grader has to not only identify the text feature, but has to make judgment on the author's use of that text feature and how it impacted their ability to get information from the informational text. Remember, so 80% of a performance-based assessment is informational text. So the demand, after you identify the skills that every kid needs, then you have to identify the demand that every student must meet. And so then we take the skill and the demand, and we create the five-question test. And the five-question pre-test, post-test, the pre-test is the post-test. We give the same test to the kids on Monday that we give to them on Friday. And so, for reasons of reliability and validity. But we don't teach the test in the middle of the week. So, what we just, so if we have a test on prefixes, the teachers across content areas teach prefixes in general without trying to teach the test that they're given in their content area. And so, then we have a spreadsheet. This spreadsheet has, if I'm an elementary teacher, then I don't, you know, my classes don't change. I have the same kids all day, obviously, except for when they go out for a, you know, PE or art or music. If I have a middle school, if I'm teaching in a middle school, then if I teach four classes, then I have four data centers in my classroom. And these data centers include a student ID number that the student knows, and this is posted on the wall in the classroom. In addition to the student ID number on this spreadsheet, you have how the student performed on the performance-based assessment in the previous year. So in my state, we have B, P, or A, basic, proficient, or advanced, below, on, or above. In some states, it said meeting standard, exceeding standard, approaching standard. So we have that designation on the Excel spreadsheet as well. That's posted in every classroom. And also, we have every skill that will be taught for that school year. So at the top of the spreadsheet, you have making inferences, drawing conclusion, author's viewpoint, author's argument, summarizing, making inferences, prefixes, suffixes, root words, vocabulary, and context. All the skills we know will appear on the test. And each week, the kids come into the classroom after they've taken the pretest. So let's say they take the pretest on Monday. The kids come into the classroom on Tuesday, they see how they have performed on the pretest. And the pretest is always five questions, so the kids will see a score 0 through 5. And they race to the back of the classroom to see how they perform on a skill that they know will appear on the test at the end of the school year. And then the teachers work with them a few minutes before they teach their content area on that skill. So they may write a mini lesson, or they may just put five words on the board that have the root word gray, and then ask the kids, you see all these words with the root word gray? What do you think is the meaning of the Latin root word gray? So when they say congregate, segregate, aggregate, egregious, we hope that they'll say group. And if they don't, then we tell them that it means group. But we don't send them to a dictionary to look it up, because that doesn't build students' vocabulary. If students are avid readers, that may build their vocabulary, but looking a word up in a dictionary does not build their vocabulary. So And then each month, we take a look at the four skills that we're focused on in reading, English, and social studies, and we do a monthly data scan. And we look and we say, well, oh, now we know across the board in sixth grade, our students are struggling with vocabulary and context. So that gives us, as a learner community, information that tells us what to do with our homework assignment, that tells us that we need to infuse vocabulary and context activities in our content area instruction. Otherwise, we have to wait to the end of the school year to know if students don't understand vocabulary and context or they don't understand these assessment limits. And that's too late because they would have already taken the state exam. I hope I answered that question.
Okay, we have had a couple more questions come in as well. Andy Johns asked, to clarify on the performance objective, I understand that it needs to incorporate what the student needs to know and what the student needs to do. If the objective is missing one of the above components, then it is flawed?
Correct.
Okay. And then the second question she had was, when you spoke on the culture of instruction, how do you overcome cultural diversity when teaching high-risk student population groups so that an instructor is talking their language?
Well, Lisa Delput wrote a book in 2006 called Other People's Children. And she talked about the importance of teachers who are from different cultural backgrounds in their student body and how to honor the language differences that exist in the classroom and how to include those into your daily instruction. Because if you have a classroom where the teacher focuses on correcting students, you know, use of language, and they do it in a public setting for the other kids to see that the kid being corrected. And what that does is it doesn't build a relationship between the teacher and the student. And so, of course, you may be thinking, well, teachers don't have time to have one-on-one conversations with kids about misplaced modifiers or dangling participles or double negatives in sentences. And so what Lisa Delpit argues is that we take a moment, like when a kid comes into class, and pull them to the side and say, you know, yesterday when you said, you know, that, you know, you said the sentence that way, let me tell you the academic way to say it so that I know when you talk to your friends you don't use that, you don't speak in this academic language, and that's okay because you're talking to your friends. But when you come in the classroom, I want you to try to use the academic instructional language, because in life you will be in situations where, you know, people will judge you based upon your lack of knowledge of academic language. And so what I find is that when teachers honor, you know, a kid's common vernacular, then it builds a relationship which makes them receptive to those sidebar one-on-one conversations about the use of academic language. I think it's important for, you know, when we do lessons on grammar, you know, we don't start our units with, okay, let's learn predicates, let's learn subject and verb, let's learn adjectives. What we do is we follow the Fred Newman model. Fred Newman from the Chicago Public Schools research from 93 and 91, he talked about authentic intellectual instruction. And what we do is we bring in someone to interview kids. And we don't prep them. So we don't talk to them about, you know, common, you know, friend vernacular versus academic language, and we have someone from our human resources department in our school system, or someone, a parent who works in human resources, and we have the kids participate in a mock interview, a series of mock interviews, and on the rubric, we have, the kids don't know it, but we have the use of language, clear communication. And then the kids go through the interview, and then we give the kids the responses from the person that interviewed them so that they can have an imperative for understanding, you know, subject-verb agreement. So when they get to the actual content-related instruction, they have an experience that makes them believe that learning the, you know, subject-verb agreement is important. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, but we've seen significant gains. And so when, you know, our students talk to one another, we encourage them in the cafeteria to use whatever language they use as long as it's not obscene. But when they come into the classroom, because they've been through this human resources interview, they understand the importance of being able to flip the switch and use academic language.
Okay, we have one last quick question before we wrap up here. Jamie asked if they can get a list of the which objectives are good and which ones aren't. Is that in the book, or is that...
Yes, it's in the book.
Okay. And that's what I wanted to let everyone know, that we do have the book on the integrated approach. You can purchase it from our website, which is ahaprocess.com, ahaprocess.com. And the book is $14.95. If you order five or more copies, they're $12.95 each. So you can order those directly from our website with a credit card, or if you need to use a purchase order from your school district, you can fax that purchase order to us. So if you're interested in more information about the model that Dr. Dickey's been speaking about today, we do have that in the book.
And I really did not do the model justice with the 1 hour conversation. I mean, it usually takes me, you know, a day, 5-6 hours to explain the model, the components of the model, the intricacies of it. For example, on page 25 of the book, I talk about instructional imperatives, and one of the instructional imperatives is coded seating charts. And coded seating charts, you may think, well, why would you need a coded seating chart? Well, what we do when a qualified observer enters a classroom, the qualified observer has information readily as they walk into the classroom to know who's who in the classroom. So a student who performed at the basic level in the previous year has one line underneath their name. Now, this coded seating chart is not public, so kids don't know. Kids don't really pay attention to it. But it's on a clipboard in the classroom, turned face down. And so as I enter the classroom, I can know who was basic, proficient, or advanced. So one line under a kid's name is basic. Two lines under a kid is proficient. Three lines under a kid's name is advanced. A period after the kid's name means that they're receiving special ed services. An asterisk next to their name means that they're receiving services under the English language proficiency program. And it teaches, that not only teaches the teacher who's in the classroom, because many of us say we know our kids, we know the learner. But I'm surprised at how many teachers and even administrators don't know at what level their students have been performing in previous years. So how can I plan targeted instruction for you, and I don't know how you've been performing? If no one tells me how you've been performing, then I know that's sensitive information, but we, you know, do training with the teachers on, you know, how to keep that information, how to use that information, and how not to abuse that information. And so as I come into the classroom as a qualified observer, I want to look to see how basic students are being paired with proficient students, so that when it's time for group work, the kids can coach one another. Because believe it or not, the language that the kids speak, they can teach each other better than I can ever teach them, because they understand one another and the misconceptions that they have about the content. So this book is loaded with tips under each one of the eight components of the model.
And just a conclusion, if you have any more questions, or if you maybe sent a question in the last few minutes that didn't get through the email server yet, go ahead and send those to questions@ahaprocess.com, and we will forward those on to Dr. Dickey and have him respond to those individually. If you sent a question in the last few minutes that may not have come through the server just yet, but we will definitely take care of getting a response back to you. Thank you again for attending today. You will be receiving an email with the next teleconference, which is scheduled for next month. Let me give you the date for that real quick. It will be on Thursday, April the 22nd, and it will be on getting students to meet or exceed standards. We'll be having some clients that have used the work of AHA Process, and we'll be explaining to you how they do that in their classroom, and you will receive an online invitation again as well for that next month. And so thank you again for attending today, and if you have any questions, again, you can email those to questions@ahaprocess.com.
To anyone who was not able to make it today within your organization, this teleconference was recorded, and it will be available in that same email with the invitation to our next one as a downloadable link. So just look for it there. I hope everyone has a wonderful day.